David, good morning.
Good morning, Tess. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So for those who may not have heard of the project, could you tell us a little bit about what it is and what it aims to do?
So a couple of theatre historians and myself were talking years ago now about the fact that we occasionally stumble across these fragments of plays, these incomplete plays in research libraries, and no one else really heard about them. And so we thought we really need to formalise this conversation, and we decided we might set up a website, which is now called the Lost Plays Database. So essentially, it's a wiki. It's like a Wikipedia, but it's only theatre historians and Shakespeare scholars who contribute to it. And we post entries about these kinds of fragments or references to plays and things like that. And the idea being to raise the visibility of this invisible drama, for want of a better term. So the plays that survive from Shakespeare's period are actually in a distinct minority. And whenever we make these generalizations about those were the times and this is what Shakespeare was doing, we're making those generalizations on the basis of the minority evidence rather than the majority. So this project's all about trying to flesh out that context for understanding Shakespeare and seeing a much richer picture of the period.
And so do we know how much of this theatrical history is actually missing?
We've got a fair indication. We have, obviously, some things are lost but have left a trace. That's the 700 or so figure that you mentioned before. So we have titles for those plays or eyewitness accounts, descriptions of them, things like that. But we could also take a step back and think about how many plays needed to have been written at this point in time, because this is not just one theatre operating in London, not just Shakespeare's theatre. There's a bunch of theatres, a whole bunch of different companies, and they were competing for the playgoer patronage. They wanted to put bums on the seats, basically. So if they're going to perform plays 6 days a week, how many plays do they need to have in their repertory in order to keep getting customers to come back again and again and again? And we figured out probably about 3,000 plays in total.
Whoa.
So that's quite a lot of plays, and out of all that, only 540 or so have actually survived.
Wow, yeah, that's not that many at all.
No, it's really not. Their survival is just a fluke. It's a miracle, really, in many ways.
That's amazing. So how much is your project hoping to recover?
Well, there's two ways of recovering things, I guess. There's the Indiana Jones style raiding the archive and hoping to actually discover a manuscript. And that does happen every few years. People do keep coming up with new manuscripts or printed plays, which is fantastic. Invariably, they tend to be of a lower quality. They tend to be academic plays, Latin plays, amateur plays, things like that. We're still waiting for one of Shakespeare's couple of lost plays to finally turn up again. But the other way is just to assemble all the detailed information, because that can tell us quite a lot about a play. It can help us understand why a company would have bothered to commission it, or why they would have purchased it and decided to perform it, and how that context sheds light on the surviving plays. So in Australia, we have the premier Shakespeare company, the Bell Shakespeare Company. Sometimes they'll do something called, you know, a Roman season, where they'll put Julius Caesar and Antony Cleopatra together. And that's basically what a repertory theatre did in Shakespeare's day. They had a whole bunch of plays that spoke to each other. So if we have a title of a lost play, that can help us understand how it relates to the surviving plays, basically.
And so what effects on, I guess, you know, academia and just theatre in general could learning more about these lost plays actually have?
Well, it can stand to make us reconsider Shakespeare's plays quite radically. And Shakespeare's been studied for a long time now, and especially in the early days, in the 1800s, say, it was really men of letters, and I'm sorry, it was just men at that point, who were allowed into research libraries. And so they would report back to the general public their findings, and that kind of ossified into fact. And it wasn't necessarily a certain thing. But these become the dominant narratives, and they get accepted over the centuries, and people stop questioning it, and they stop thinking freshly about Shakespeare. So looking at it from this different angle is quite enabling. It lets you start reinterpreting the plays and sort of moving away from those received narratives to exploring it for yourself. So I'll give you one really quick example is Shakespeare's Henry V, which is a very famous play for its military conquest, very nationalistic, the English versus French, all that sort of stuff. Right at the heart of that play, Henry is wooing his future wife, Catherine. At the very end of the play, he is seen to be almost about to marry Catherine. Only two very brief scenes. But the playing company literally across the road at the Rose Theatre, the Admiral's Men, responded by putting on a play called Owen Tudor, which is now lost. Owen was Catherine's second husband, and it seems to have been a romance play. So they decided, if we're going to try and steal some of Shakespeare's audiences, we're not going to offer a war play, we're going to focus on Catherine and being in love. So that was sort of the most important take-home message from Henry V from them, was the centrality of Catherine.
It does seem like there's just a rabbit hole where it just keeps going and going on. David, I guess, looking into the future a little bit,
yeah.
How much more do you think that you're going to be able to find in the next few years? Is there a steady rate that you do sort of piece together these plays in?
Well, a lot of the material is already out there. A lot of people have transcribed it and recorded it in different places, but it's never been brought together, and the sum is greater than the parts. So it's an extensive effort just with this team of scholars just trying to comb through all the records and trying to put them all together in the one place. Once we do that, it's then a question of how we interpret that information. So facts are one thing, but what spin you put on those facts, or you know what they give rise to in terms of interpretation, is something that will be just ongoing, really. But my position is essentially that the more information we have, the more accurate we can be, the more responsible we can be. And one of the things that I'm really keen to do with our database, which is completely open access, free to use the general public, is to actually digitize historical records wherever possible and provide you with direct access. So you sitting at home on your laptop can actually see the historical record from the 1500s or 1600s. So it's really more about making things available, and then we can start the business of interpretation.
It is absolutely fascinating. David, I am going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us on the show this morning.
Thank you, Tess. Much appreciated.